This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're going to speak with attorney Kevin Zeese from Washington, D.C., one of the members of the Embassy Protectors Collective.
Kevin and three others are about to go to trial. They face a year in prison and $250,000 fine merely for protecting the embassy against the encroachments of a failed coup.
We'll also speak with attorney Paromita Shah, the executive director of the newly established organization Just Futures Law.
This is a group of very smart women organizing in court and in the streets to protect our immigrant communities.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Well, hello, everybody. We're recording in our New York studio today, January 2nd. A happy new year. I'm with my friend Natasha Bonin. Natasha is substituting for Heidi Boghossian, who's riding out on the bench this week. She'll hopefully be back next week. We asked Natasha to come in. I should say, Natasha, welcome back, because you were on as a guest one time, and now you're on as my co-host. Folks should know that Natasha works for Latino Justice. She's the former president of the National Lawyers Guild and the former editor-in-chief of the City of New York Law School. It's a pleasure to have her here. We've got a good show for you. Natasha, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be here again, and Happy New Year to all of our listeners.
Yeah, and every New Year I think about Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and the others who led the Cuban Revolution, beginning their march from Santa Clara in the middle of the country over to Havana, and finally getting there a few days later and occupying the, what was called the Hilton Hotel. They called it the Havana Libre, and that was the start of the revolutionaries in Cuba kicking out the 1% and the 99% taking over. What does the Cuban Revolution mean to you, Natasha?
It's such an interesting question to ponder, particularly in these politically tumultuous times, when I find that so many movements and activists really are struggling with defining and thinking about a politically progressive solution and even visualizing what does it mean, what's the political possibility of collective liberation. And yet we have this living example 90 miles from our coast of what Cuba was able to accomplish 61 years ago. And to think about what collective struggle looks like in a way that is not just kind of disconnected the way I think sometimes our movements can be in the United States and abroad, but to think of ourselves as a people whose, you know, liberation is intricately tied with the other, and to defend that. And it isn't just the defense of, you know, the way, you know, in Cuba it was at the beginning, right, public safety and making sure that the resources belong to the Cuban people and not were at service of some foreign capital. But as they say in Cuba, really, it's an ongoing revolution. Every day you have these different revolutionary conquests, whether it's education, healthcare, housing, social security, things that we consider, you know, perks or benefits or here. And in fact, are actually rights that were won and continue to be defended. It's tremendously, you know, inspirational to think about what people just a few miles off our coast are doing.
Well, let's talk about how it all started. You have the 26th of July movement, poor peasants, workers in the cities, students, elements of the middle class, intelligentsia. Batista, on New Year's Eve, gets out of town, gets on a plane and flies to the Dominican Republic, and the 99% are now in power. The first thing they do, Che Guevara wrote and implemented the agrarian reform law. And in those days, 61 years ago, most of Cuba was owned by foreign interests, especially the United States. There were 10 million acres, farm acres, devoted to tobacco and sugar cane that were controlled by the United States. So the Cubans said, we want to give land to the poor peasants who cultivated this land. These peasants worked about 3 months a year. They had no shoes. They lived in grass huts. They were undernourished. Their children were uneducated and illiterate. it was just a terrible situation for the majority of the Cuban population. So the agrarian reform law said that we're going to break up these big estates and we're going to give the land to the people who work it. We're not going to steal it. We're going to pay the owners. We're going to pay them according to how much they listed the value of these properties for tax purposes. Mm-hmm. And they offered to pay the American companies that amount of money. American companies said no, and they retaliated. The American oil refinery refined all Cuban oil, so they cut off the refining of Cuban oil. The Cubans had no gasoline. The country would have ground to a halt. So the Cubans, in defense, nationalized the oil refineries. Then they nationalized the phone company. Then they nationalized the nickel mines, and so on and so on. And they took over and they ran these businesses according to what would be best for the Cuban people. That, in a nutshell, is the Cuban Revolution.
And to think about, as you said, that they focused on the areas of their country that were the most lucrative and had been producing resources, but not for Cubans, not for the benefit of Cubans, not for the future of Cubans, but really at the behest and service of foreign interest. And that was the ultimate blow. It wasn't a military assault, right? It was, how dare you challenge our economic historic economic intervention in your country?
You know what it reminds me of? You know, the oil and gas industry get more subsidies from the American government than does all of American education. And now the oil and gas industry are fracking, and they're selling that fracked gas overseas. It's not even for American use. That's exactly what they did in Cuba.
And they now enjoy the protection of the state, right? Whether it's, you know, before it was private security guards, and now if you just think back to like Standing Rock, for example, or what's happening with coal ash company, U.S. coal ash companies in Puerto Rico, where it's state police or state troops that are sent to defend them and against public protests who are saying these are our lands, our resources, and we're not going to continue to be exposed to the harmful toxins that are either being produced, or we are going to assert our control over these resources as they're on our lands, and the state is now in, you know, serving in protection of corporate interest.
It's this land is your land, it is not our land, and they reverse that one. Well, the Cubans have been harassed, blockaded, even militarily invaded in the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961 for the last 61 years, and it's really just an extraordinary miracle that they've been able to hold out against all that hostility.
And not only to do so, but to do so with the vast amount of international support. When you think about the annual resolution that gets presented in the United Nations
each
year.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. What was the last vote in the United Nations to lift the blockade of Cuba? What were the numbers on that?
It's typically always unanimous support to lift the blockade with either two oppositions or abstentions. That's the United States and Israel.
And the Marshall Islands.
And the
You forgot the Marshall Islands.
There were two additional abstentions this year. I believe one was the Ukraine, and we can imagine why, for their own political interests, that was the case. And I forget the other, but instead, you know, the last year under Obama, the United States abstained, and Israel, always following the United States' lead, also abstained. This year, and as last year under Trump, they opposed. But when you see this resolution, which is, I understand, is the only resolution that gets proposed in the General Assembly that has nearly unanimous support of all the issues that get discussed in the international community and in the United Nations, this is the only one where you see such unanimous support and recognition that this is not only in violation of international law, but against the very principles that the UN Charter stands for.
Well, the economic, commercial, and financial blockade of Cuba, which is going on almost from the beginning, has stunted the growth of the Cuban economy. It's cost the Cubans tens of billions of dollars. This is precisely what the United States designed it to do, because it doesn't want the Cuban Revolution to be an example to the world. And that's what they tried to do. And that's exactly what they're trying to do in Venezuela, isn't it?
It's exactly right. you know, the attack on Cuba isn't just an ideological one. It's that the United States says we cannot have an example of a successful socialist revolution because that challenges our economic model. Not just the it gets reduced to a political discourse of, well, democracy or human rights. That's not actually it. It's actually saying we cannot have a successful economic model that is not capitalism, because to do so would inspire others, particularly in the region. It's the same, you know, thinking about Puerto Rico and now Venezuela, and Venezuela's political and economic role in integrating the region and reducing the dependence in various ways on the United States is the actual threat. It isn't just that we're concerned about, you know, human rights in these countries. Obviously, I mean, just look at Guantanamo in Cuba, the base that the United States continues to hold and occupy and use as a torture space. But it's that, as you said, from the very beginning of the Cuban Revolution, where the actual threat was taking back ownership over the resources that produced wealth for the nation and putting those back in Cuban hands, the threat is the threat against capitalism.
That's what the United States was afraid of in the first great socialist revolution in the world in 1917 in Russia. And the Russians were able, in the short space of 25 years, to bring that country out of really was a semi-feudal existence into the modern world and modernize their economy. And they did it because they planned it. And if you think about it, producing stuff for profit and not as a plan is a crazy way to do things. But that's what's done in the United States now. This country could be a country that supports all its citizens, not just the top 1%. You know, as we go into 2020, 40% of the American workforce makes less than $18,000 a year. So the country may look good on the surface because the 1% is living so lavishly, but underneath, it's a terrible situation. That doesn't need to be. If this economy was taken over by us and planned and worked out, everybody could live well. And that's the example the United States doesn't want to see in Latin America and especially here. First week of January 2020 marks the 61st anniversary of the Cuban Revolution. The Cuban people now have some of the best health care in the world, free education through college, adequate housing, and a high level of culture. The attitude of the American government towards Cuba has been one of unrelenting hostility, including violence and an ongoing economic, financial, and commercial blockade. Unable to reverse the Cuban Revolution, the United States sought from the beginning to contain its influence. From the 1960s, the governments of Chile, Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, and the Dominican Republic, Uruguay, and recently Bolivia were overthrown by American-sponsored coups because of their friendly position towards Cuba. As of today, the Venezuelan government is being targeted by the USA. In violation of international law, in May of 2019, the United States government attempted but failed to overthrow the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. The U.S. had at that time attempted to install Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela, and Guaido's right-wing supporters attempted to take over the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. Under international law, the embassy is the property of the Venezuelan government and is considered untouchable. A number of Americans, known as the embassy protectors, moved in to the embassy to prevent its hostile takeover. The State Department, Secret Service, and the Metropolitan Police Force laid siege to the embassy. Electricity and water were cut off. No food was allowed in. Although the coup against the Maduro government failed, the embassy protectors were arrested when the U.S. government raided the embassy. Four of the protectors, including today's Law and Disorder guest, attorney Kevin Zeese, were arrested and face trial. If convicted, they could be fined up to $250,000 and given a one-year prison term. Kevin Zeese is an attorney in Washington, D.C., and works with the organization Popular Resistance. Kevin Zeese, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
Kevin, can you remind our listeners what the Embassy Protectors Collective is and why you all spent 37 days in the Venezuelan Embassy this past spring?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me on, and I hope everyone has a great 2020. Yeah, we were in the embassy, as you said, for 37 days, and we were there because the U.S. government was working with people trying to create a coup in Venezuela, which had failed in Venezuela multiple times. There, so they tried to take over Venezuelan properties in the United States and other countries. They'd already taken over the diplomatic missions in New York for the UN. They'd already taken over the military attaché building. And so we went to the embassy and said we wanted to stand in solidarity with the Venezuelan people. We wanted to uphold international law. And we thought we could do a better job protecting the embassy from being inside. And so about up to 70 people stayed in the embassy. As it went on, it was initially fantastically easy. People could come in and come out. We had forums every night. 100 people would come to these forums. They'd be live streamed. There were no conflicts, no problems with the police. Everything was running fine. But then there was another coup attempt in Caracas on April 30th. And on that same day, there were coup protesters who came to the embassy. These were all right-wing, wealthy Venezuelans, Cubans, Nicaraguans, people who had left their countries when progressive left country governments had come into play and were living in the United States. So these were right-wing, oligarch-type people.
We're talking about mostly white people here, aren't we?
Well, they were Latin American. Some were Venezuelan, and they surrounded the embassy. And they surrounded the embassy with the approval of the Secret Service. The police allowed them to do it. They were threatening us, trying to terrorize us with lights and noise and threatening our attacking people outside who came to support us. When people were assaulted outside, our allies, the police would arrest the people who were victims rather than the people who committed the assault. And they eventually blocked our food supply. They wouldn't allow any food to come in, and the Secret Service didn't do anything to change that. And as it developed, they turned off the electricity, they turned off the water, and we shrunk down gradually as we had less food and less electricity and water to smaller groups so we could stay longer. In the end, it was finally four people, myself and three others, who were arrested after 37 days when the police came into the embassy with military-style gear, more than 100 police. And arrested us, even though we were nonviolent protesters who had told the police we would not resist arrest if they came in. So we are now facing federal charges. You can read about that at defendembassyprotectors.org. Federal charges for interfering with protective function. And we'll probably be going to trial sometime in February. So that's where it currently stands.
So, Kevin, speak to us a little bit more about the case. What additional charges are there? Who's bringing them against you? What's the status now of the case? You mentioned going to trial, but beyond that.
Well, these are federal charges, so we're in federal court in Washington, D.C., U.S. District Court, and we are facing one charge, interfering with protective function of the State Department. The State Department, under law, is the agency responsible for protecting foreign embassies. The Secret Service is the primary police group in charge of that, although there are multiple police forces involved in this event. And so the charges are, they didn't charge us the trespass because we weren't trespassing. We were there legally. We had a key to enter and exit, and didn't break and enter, so they couldn't charge us of that. So they came with this unusual charge, interfering with protective function, which is interesting to us because we saw ourselves as serving a protective function, and we actually worked with the police. When people broke into the embassy, we actually helped the police remove them. So it's kind of strange we charged with interfering with protective function when we were actually protecting the embassy.
Why do you think the United States is so eager to prosecute this case, and what do you think, you know, the precedential value or effect it could have?
Well, this is that's a multi-part question there. I think they're pursuing the case because the coup in Venezuela has failed and failed and failed, and the appointed president, self-proclaimed interim president Juan Guaido, is getting weaker and weaker. In fact, this week there'll be an election in the National Assembly in Venezuela to see whether he stays the president of the assembly. The opposition is divided, so they failed in Venezuela, so they need to do something outside of Venezuela to make it look like there was a coup. And so the U.S. Embassy was one of probably about four or five that were attacked around the world by the coup supporters when they failed inside Caracas. And so they're pursuing this, I think, because they want to, you know, make a case that there really is an alternative government when there isn't. Maduro has been in power. In fact, you and I were there for the election. He was reelected in a well-run election with hundreds of international election observers who unanimously said he was reelected, meaning all the levels of requirements of international law for a democratic election. And so they're desperate. And because they broke into the embassy in violation of the Vienna Convention, which requires the U.S. government to protect embassies in the U.S. and does not allow the U.S. to enter those embassies without permission of the government, the U.S. broke that convention, which is very serious. And when they first told us that they were going to evict us, we warned them that if you violate the Vienna Convention, no embassy around the world is safe, because that's what protects all embassies, including U.S. embassies and U.S. personnel. So it's so interesting. We just went through this recent event in Iraq where the U.S. embassy was under attack there. And that is the kind of thing we see will happen in the future as the Vienna Convention has been weakened by the United States entering the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. So it's a very serious impact.
Yeah, it's another benchmark in the decline of the rule of law in this country, particularly accelerated by Trump. But Kevin, let me step back for a second. Why are you and the others so passionate about defending Venezuela? What were the positive things about the Maduro government's achievements and Chavez before him? What are we talking about here? What are we protecting? Who's who?
Great question, because there's a lot of confusion around that in the United States. We have so much misinformation. One thing we saw in Venezuela, I've been there twice in the last year, once with Natasha for the election and once this year with a peace delegation. Last year, we're now in 2020. It was in 2019 with a peace delegation. And what we saw in Venezuela and what we've reviewed in our many reports on popular resistance about Venezuela is an incredible support for the poorest people. Even in the last week, they announced more than now 3 million social housing units, 3 million housing units, each containing for about four people. That's 12 million people getting free social housing units. And that's 12 million people out of a population of about 30 million. The United States, with a population of 320 million, has 1 million public housing units. So Venezuela has tripled the number, despite an economic war by the United States. So housing, we couldn't find a homeless person in Venezuela. I live in Baltimore. It's hard to drive anywhere without seeing homeless people. They've done incredible work on literacy, reducing literacy illiteracy dramatically, on health care, making health care available with actually support from Cuban doctors. Incredible health care. When we traveled into one community that was a barrio of 1.5 million people, it was not even on the maps prior to Chavez because they got no government services. Now you go to that community, you see transit, you see subways, buses, you see schools, recreation centers, you see urban gardens. Urban gardening has become very good because of the U.S. economic war. They've had to create a resistance economy where they provide their own food, and a lot of it comes from urban gardening. About 25% of their food now comes from urban gardening. They're very proud of that. And so you can actually see on the ground in this community that was ignored, not even on the map prior to Chavez, now is a thriving community of 1.5 million people. It's quite amazing.
Attorney Kevin Zeese, you're facing criminal charges, and Natasha wanted to ask you, since we're coming to an end of our allotted time here, Natasha wanted to ask you what's next. Natasha?
Well, given the tremendous, you know, social and economic advances that you just talked about in Venezuela, and the fact that the United States, despite that, continues to tighten its grip of unilateral sanctions against Venezuela. We know unilateral sanctions violate international law. You know, their failed coup has led to, as you said, the disgrace Juan Guaido being rejected even within his own country and certainly internationally. What do you think is next for Venezuela? I mean, do you think that we're going to see a military intervention like the one that we just saw in Bolivia being planned?
Well, I think that the U.S. would like to do that, but that's not going to happen. Venezuela, unlike Bolivia, the military is solidly on the side of the Constitution and the constitutional government of President Maduro. There's no question under international law and under domestic law, Maduro is the president and has always been. There will not be a military coup. There will not be military intervention because Venezuela has been preparing for military intervention ever since President Trump started talking about one in August of 2017. And they've now developed a civilian militia of millions of people who are armed and trained and ready to defend their homeland. They have anti-missile systems provided by Russia so that an aerial campaign by the United States won't be successful. When President Trump talked about a naval blockade, Russia decided to move a Navy ship into the Venezuelan port to let the United States know that that would not be acceptable. The countries of Brazil and Colombia, which are the two closest U.S. allies that border Venezuela, are in turmoil themselves because of protests and corruption, especially in Brazil with the Bolsonaro government under constant attack, and in Cuba, Colombia, massive protests. So they're not interested in getting involved in a military action. What we see also is the economy is beginning to turn around. They're adapting to the unilateral coercive measures, the sanctions that are illegally put in place by the United States. The economy is beginning to grow for the first time in years. People I know who just got back from Venezuela notice a marked difference in the economic activity. So I think I see some progress. If people want to learn about what's going to happen in our case, they should come to an event in New York City on the 24th at the People's Forum at 7 p.m., a whole group of organizations.
That's the 24th of January.
24th of January, People's Forum at 7 p.m. You can, all four of the us who are being prosecuted will be there. So you can learn a lot more there. And at Embassy Protectors, defendembassyprotectors.org, you can learn a great deal more about this. We have a frequently asked question page that answers a lot more questions. We are very pleased that there's a defense committee that formed to help defend us. So it's not just the four of us against the U.S. government. We feel very confident in our group.
Well, Kevin, just to wrap up here, since we started talking about the Embassy Protectors Collective and the case, you know, you're going to trial soon. It seems like you've had some difficulties in defending the case against the prosecution of it, including some of, as I understand, some denied motions. Can you just briefly tell us what it is that you all are facing and what some of the challenges have been in the courtroom that those who are in New York at least can go hear a little bit more about in a few weeks?
Yeah, this is, by the way, part of a Northeast tour, so there'll be other talks. It'll be on the Defend Embassy Protectors page, a schedule of our events, so you can catch us not just in New York but other places. The big challenge is that under U.S. law, President Trump can say who the president of Venezuela is. If he says Mickey Mouse is the president and Mickey Mouse says Donald Duck is the ambassador, that is in the courtroom, that is the reality. And so it's a fantasy land in the courtroom. Everyone in the world knows, everyone in the courtroom knows that Guaido is not the president, Maduro is the president, that Vecchio is not the ambassador, and that they have a real foreign minister. And so everyone knows it's a fantasy, but the judge is acting on that fantasy because that's what U.S. law requires. U.S. law, we ignore international law. We have this kind of absurd position that President Trump can say Mickey Mouse was the president, even though he's not. And that gives Mickey Mouse powers. I mean, so that's the fantasy we got to deal with. And the judge is trying to limit what we can say about Maduro is actually the president. Vecchio was not the ambassador. And that's central to the case. That's the battle. How do we get the truth into the courtroom? And if the jury, we have a jury trial, a right to a jury trial, we're facing a year in jail and up to a $100,000 fine each for this offense. And so we have a right to a jury. But the problem is, will the jury be allowed to hear the truth? And that's really the conflict that we're facing.
Well, Kevin Zeis, it's been a pleasure having you on Law and Disorder. I want to remind folks that on January 24th at 7 o'clock at the People's Forum, you'll be speaking personally. People should show up for that and come out and support you. We're going to have to say goodbye now. We've run out of our allotted time. Kevin Zeis of the Embassy Protectors, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to your audience.
You take it easy and a good new year.
I'm ready.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Anti-immigrant discourse and policy has defined a large part of the Trump administration since 2016. We take a look into attacks against immigrants in the United States and related rulemaking in the last few months. We get into more detail with Paramita Shah, Executive Director of Just Futures Law, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Paramita, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be on.
Paramita, it's great to have you with us. I know that you and some fellow colleagues just started a new organization called Just Futures Law. Can you explain a little bit about what you all do and what the organization is about?
Sure, I'd love to. We started last year. We're a new legal shop. We're led by women of color working for grassroots groups because we believe that directly impacted communities are the heart, soul, and tactical brain of the immigrant rights movement, and they also need legal support. And so what that means for us is that we work alongside community organizing and campaigns. We build litigation labs that lift up organizing campaigns to end criminalization. And we also work on advocacy and policy strategies that can meet the bold and visionary demands of our movement, and we're very interested in also building that political home for those who want to build with us as lawyers who recognize that they are the tactical brain of our movement.
Well, it certainly couldn't come at a better time, as you well know. You know, as the country continues this decades-long wait for immigration reform, whatever that's going to look like now. You know, Trump, as we've seen, continues to really warp the powers of the executive and to find ways to break up and target immigrant families, to dehumanize and criminalize immigrants, and to expand the immigrant deportation and detention machine, which you all are intimately working on. And that machine being primarily run by private for-profit companies. What are some of the most concerning attacks that you all have seen as of late that have gone unnoticed to the general public and that you think that we really need to be paying more attention to?
Yeah, you know, I think you put a really good lens on this issue because there are so many unrelenting attacks on immigrants, and the focus of this administration is to criminalize and surveil and intimidate, detain, deport immigrants. And, you know, at the same time, the cruelty of these new policies is the point. But I do think there are some things that we do need to pay attention to and require a shift in how we think about the Department of Homeland Security and how we think about immigration enforcement. And number one is that, you know, instead of looking at DHS just as an immigration agency, it's really the largest police agency in the United States. And like many police agencies, it is rapidly, if not already there, moving into using, you know, next generation surveillance technology into being a massive data broker to police, in essence, I think everyone. And what that looks like is it means more biometric collection, like your DNA, your iris scans, your fingerprinting. It means buying data from private companies. It means sweeping your social media and the social media of your friends and family, like collecting your geospatial location over days through your phone or maybe through an ankle monitor if you've ever been arrested for weeks. It means looking at your utility bills, your DMV history, and all this, like what it means is that DHS is a police agency that is building a DHS profile of you and of the people around you. And all that information that is being collected is premised on this idea that you're an immigrant, and that it's okay to collect that information, and that it's okay to use it for prosecutions. You know, we most recently saw that in the largest worksite raid in ICE history in Mississippi, where, you know, over 600 people were arrested in one day. And I think the test or the marker for this is that the most recent appropriations that were given to DHS essentially gave a green light and a big payout to those programs and services that do everything that we describe. So we talk about a wall and how the wall represents, you know, and it does represent, like, the symbol of white supremacy that this administration is building, but we also have a tech wall. It's a surveillance wall that we're also building, and we're building it, you know, as most surveillance programs are built, without the accountability, without oversight, and with a lot of bipartisan support. And, you know, just as the detention and deportation machine grew to $1 billion agency with a billions of dollars of market money available for this industry, you know, I think we have to look at this other industries, all these other industries in the surveillance and policing side that are flowing into DHS, and we have to put the brakes on it. So that's number one. And number two is, I think, the criminalization policies on the DOJ side is, you know, impact immigrants as well, you know, whether it's on the Department of Justice or on the state side. So whether we see resurgence of drug prosecutions, increases in sentencing, more gang profiling programs, or prosecution priorities, I think that has a major impact on immigrants. And the classic example for me is this, is that we all know that family separation is a horrible thing, but the driver of that is the criminal prosecution of migration. And, you know, that is, those kinds of prosecutions are leading to hundreds of thousands of convictions per year, and they are leading to mass family separations. And then the very last point that I think that is the hardest for lawyers to accept is the courts that have been transformed by Trump. At the very best, you know, our courts, which are now Trumpified, we're not going to see those victories that we have seen, and we're probably going to see the courts be misused again to perpetuate injustice. And not only will we see that at the Supreme Court, but at the circuit courts of appeals in which many of these battles are fought on immigration. And I think it's going to be a hard pill for us to swallow when we see some of these wins that people have fought for decades basically dwindling or diminishing over time.
Paramita, I wanted to ask you, how are immigration lawyers responding to the nonstop attacks on immigrants and their families?
I think they have been resisting. You know, they've been, despite the unrelenting attacks, despite, like, the shifting landscape and the different types of attacks, whether it's at the border, you know, when it came to, you know, changes in asylum laws and policies and the Remain in Mexico policy and zero tolerance prosecution to new interior enforcement memos, which said that everybody, you know, in the United States is, anybody who's deportable should be deported. I think we've seen a big flank of legal services and litigation evolve. I think that's been with really diligent and amazing work done by many people, including the Guild, including folks like Natasha who've gone to the border and seen firsthand what it looks like and are able to bring back testimony. And we've seen a lot of big and small cases, like with DACA, with, you know, defending temporary protected status for the 15 countries that were designated as for temporary protected status, you know, everything from, you know, Sudan to Haiti, from Nicaragua, El Salvador, like all these places that had TPS, you know, we've seen a defense of that. And we've seen, you know, more and more lawyers really kind of get in the weeds and be more diligent in removal defense. But, you know, I think this is a really hard time because the Trump administration has made immigrants, you know, a number one target. And so as much as people are fighting. You know, we all know that immigrants don't get assigned counsel in court, so people are exhausted. You know, people are donating their time, and they're exhausted and tired as much as they are angry and emboldened in fighting. But I also wanted to give a huge shout-out to the legal workers and the organizers who I think have done amazing work to bring the new awareness of ICE's misconduct and tactics in all types of unexpected places. And I think the organizing campaigns, whether you're talking about shutting down jails or working with tech workers to talk about No Tech for ICE campaigns, those are things that we should be keeping an eye on, too.
So, Paramita, I would love to come back in a minute back to the campaigns and larger advocacy work that's being done, given some of the challenges in litigating these issues. But I do want to just quickly ask, you know, within the courtroom and the legal work that's happening, you mentioned that there have been some wins, that even though we can expect, given the state of the courts, the Trumpified courts, I think you call them, that those wins may be eventually obliterated. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what some of the wins in the courtroom have been and how they've translated to protections? Is it primarily just keeping the bare minimum that's exist and fighting against, you know, entrenched anti-immigrant attacks? Has that, and holding the line, so to say, has it led to, you know, do you think it's discouraged this administration from continuing to pursue some of these anti-immigrant efforts? Or do you think that they haven't really dissuade Trump from continuing to launch some of these attacks? Because we've seen in the last few months, for example, just in the rulemaking procedures alone, numerous rules being proposed that are intended to really break up immigrant families, as you mentioned, that are, you know, want to pull TNA out of immigrants, whether they're detained or not, et cetera. And so, you know, the wave continues to happen. But how do you think that the litigation aspect is deterring, if at all, some of these attacks?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think if we didn't have litigation to protect DACA, we wouldn't have, you know, DACA folks here, right? And, you know, without a very concerted and very deliberate litigation strategy in coordination with, you know, Dreamers, that I think DACA would be more at risk than ever before. And I think the same also applies for temporary protected status. It, you know, we, Just Futures Law is on the case for Sajay v. Trump, which is, you know, involving an attack on Haitian TPS. And I know it was through the litigation that we brought and also through FOIA litigation that was brought in the past that we learned of the actual racial animus. So the uncovering, the unveiling of the racial animus within the agency became more open for people to see and to discuss and to unravel. Because I think in the beginning it's hard for all of us to understand that there are policy people in there that have a white supremacist agenda, but now we know it has become ever more clear, you know, because we have their direct statements that the Stephen Millers, the Ken Cuccinellis, you know, those people have an agenda, and I think it's by exposing that agenda that we've been able to hold the line. But there have been, you know, some wins, you know, in Flores, for example, which involves the treatment of minors who are detained. You know, the federal judge in Los Angeles, Judge D, you know, blocked the Trump administration from activating new regulations that would have dramatically expanded the ability to detain migrant children with their parents for indefinite periods of time. You know, that's something that this administration has targeted for a long time. In the setback, even though there were many wins, you know, through preliminary injunctions for the Muslim ban, you know, we've seen cases go up to the Supreme Court really fast. And so Muslim ban version 3.0 was upheld by the Supreme Court. But there are still attacks, right, that are happening at the lower level to challenge the unlawful implementation of that ban. You know, there's a challenge, for example, that we're going to have to watch and see that happened on the same day as the DACA case called Hernandez. And Hernandez v. Mesa involved this the death of a teenager, Sergio Adrian Hernandez Gereca, who is a 15-year-old teen who was shot and killed by U.S. Border Patrol agents. And that involves, you know, whether a Bivens case can be brought.
What's a Bivens case?
Oh, that's just it's a case where you can bring damages against federal agencies, you know, for actions that were unlawful on their part. And so the idea here is that when you're shooting across the border, that those border agents should be liable for the death of that teenager. And there are numbers of cases like this. These are pivotal cases that are, you know, coming our way and that we're going to get decisions on. I think the Haitian TPS cases, you know, in Saget, there was a preliminary injunction, an injunction granted, you know, by the judge in New York in our case. And I think when it comes to sanctuary cities, there have been great gains there. And, you know, for example, there was a case called in L.A. also where kind of information sharing through what's called detainers, which are a way for DHS to track immigrants in the criminal justice system. It's a really kind of distorted tool that was held to be illegal. And courts across the country have been fending off attacks by the Trump administration to derail sanctuary cities. So I think there are a number of good victories that, you know, that are really hopeful for us. But I think we also have to be cautious because this is a time where we need all tactics. We need everything, not just the courts, to move the system. That's where I think we need to be clear that it's just not litigation that's going to bring us to victory. It's the litigation combined with organizing.
We've been talking with Attorney Paramita Shah here on Law and Disorder. Paramita, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time here, but I wanted to ask you, what are you advising movements and communities about ways that they can protect themselves and each other? Talk about campaign and advocacy work.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the reason why Just Futures Law started is because we're really interested in the visionary organizing campaigns, you know, especially campaigns like No Tech for ICE or No New Jail campaigns or the Amazon campaigns. And these are campaigns that have shut down jails that will have enormous implications for immigrants in New York and Los Angeles and D.C. and Illinois. And, you know, I think one thing that helps all of our campaigns, especially when it comes to immigrant rights, is when we kind of, these campaigns are girded by the same analysis that black and brown people are impacted by what the Trump administration is doing. And so the litigation that I think is really interesting to watch that's aligned with these campaigns are the ones that are about how to protect our sanctuary from these new threats, right, around technology policing. You know, sanctuary cities has been a major victory, a major wall against a lot of, I think, terrible immigration policies that would have rolled through cities. But without all that work that had been done before by organizing and campaign work, we wouldn't really have had the resistance that we need today. So I think that's one area that we can work on. And number two, it's more important than ever to protect leaders and activists during this time. It's one thing to be put into jail. It's another thing now for the activists to be deported also. It means like you're almost eviscerated from this moment in time here. And I think it's really critical to protect activists to be from retaliation and from threats of retaliation. And so I think that's where we have been working hard and thinking through with other community groups about how do you talk about doing civil disobedience work if you wanted to do it? How would you think about sanctuary in different ways? Those are the questions that we need to be able to talk with communities, even though these are difficult and hard conversations to have and confusing as we are lawyers, but I think it's more important than ever to ensure that activists and our leaders are protected in this moment against retaliation.
Those are such tremendously helpful, I think, pointers for all of us to think about and what it actually means to show up for immigrants at this particular political moment in our history. And I just want to briefly bring up something that you talked about that often gets ignored in this conversation, though implicitly accepted, which is really that immigration policy is also racist policy and that there's white supremacist underlying ideology that drives it, because we're not talking about all immigrant communities in the same way who are being overly policed and targeted and deported and their families separated and criminalized. Can you speak a little bit about, and you mentioned through, even through some litigation, I think that you got some information or some documents that inferred the intent that's driving these policies. What are the racist, explicit or implicit racist implications of this policy? And as we think about it in the context of not immigration policy, but policing policy, but population control policy, you know, but part an extension of the mass incarceration industrial complex, which we know targets Black and brown communities disproportionately, you know, what have you learned or what are you seeing or how do you think that we should be thinking about this intentionally surfacing race?
Yeah, I think the immigration immigration rights movement must see itself as a racial justice movement. And if it doesn't begin doing that, I think we will not avail ourselves of the analysis we need to bring the good strategies that we can build together with Black people, with queer people, with Muslims, with all the other groups that we need to build with. But to be more specific, you know, when I began researching migrant prosecutions and thinking through strategies about how do you work with federal defenders to ensure that people are being prosecuted, right? And these are my colleagues, Julie Mal and Sejal and Zoda, who've been working on these things for far longer than I have. And, you know, what they've discovered by looking at these prosecutions is the types of technologies that they use that are, frankly, used against people who are being subject to all types of prosecution, so whether it's like a stingray, surveillance and monitoring. But when you look at the laws, what stood out to me was that, you know, illegal entry itself is a 1929 law that was passed by a white supremacist in South Carolina, a senator. And when he passed illegal entry and illegal reentry, which is 18 U.S.C. 1325 and 18 U.S.C. 1326, he did it because he wanted to deter Mexican migration to the United States. It was done with that very explicit authorization to do so. And so we passed that law knowing what it was. And so it has now become the biggest driver of federal prosecutions in the United States. And in fact, it is the lead charge of all federal prosecutions. And that is an example, I think, a classic example of how racial animus is kind of baked into our immigration laws. But what we learned in the TPS litigation was something, you know, that was also truly disturbing is, you know, for years we had seen a bias in our immigration laws against Haitians in particular. There were cases under the Bush administration where Haitians were denied bond because, you know, they were just considered to be more of a flight risk than other groups of nationalities. But in this case, we found not only was Trump calling, you know, Haiti a shithole country, right, and other Caribbean nations and other African nations, whole countries. We also saw that they really wanted to create and manufacture a record that show that connected Haitians with more crime, that they're more prone to committing crimes, they're more prone to taking services, and they were looking for that evidence for a long time so that they could show that Haitians really shouldn't be in the United States. And that very much fit within their narrative that immigrants were the new super predator in the United States. And so when that information was uncovered, not only through FOIA litigation, but also by information obtained by various committees on the Hill, it really showed that and demonstrated to the judge that there was not really good decision-making that was happening to assess whether Haiti actually had overcome the conditions of a cholera epidemic that was brought by the United Nations, an earthquake that had ravaged, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. It wasn't about that. It was really focused on whether Haitians could be labeled as criminals. And once that became clear, once that information surfaced, it made it much easier, I think, for the judge to make a determination that he could lodge an injunction.
Well, Paramita Shah, it's been a pleasure having you on Law and Disorder. Before we have to let you go, can you please tell our listeners how people can contact Just Futures Law?
Sure. I'm at paramita@justfuturelaw.org, and you can go to our website, www.justfutureslaw.org.
Thank you. What you've had to say has been very helpful, and we're glad to be able to broadcast this across the country. Every success to you and your group in the new year.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Paramita.
Years, days, makes no difference to me, babe.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Crossing your legs inside the diner, raising the coffee to your lips, the steam. You saw the masterpiece.